Testing 1, 2, 3. This interview is being conducted for the Kentucky Oral History Commission by John Clee, and I'm talking to Mr. Russell Wilson. What I wanted to start with is if you could just give me a little background about you in reference to farming and growing burley tobacco.
Well, I guess, you know, I'm like a lot of people around here. I was sort of born in a tobacco patch.
Uh-huh.
So some of my earliest memories are of, you know, being very, very small and out where my dad was working in tobacco.
Yes, sir.
And it's, of course, been a history in our family from way back, the tobacco business.
Mm-hmm.
My earliest memory is of tobacco was up in Bird Township, where we live.
Yes, sir.
And strange thing about that, that I can remember, that probably maybe too many people can't, is the fact that every year farmers cleared ground to raise tobacco. They called it new ground. They did not fertilize. They went out and they cleared their acreage. And I can remember my dad and his hired help. They'd go out and clear the ground every year and blow the stumps with dynamite.
Yeah.
And clear it off. And that's where they raised their tobacco.
They plow under the old grass and weeds or whatever.
Well,
was there.
Disc it up. Get rid of the roots and the vines and do the best they could.
Uh-huh.
It's different type tobacco. It's mostly chewing tobacco, you know, snuff and things like that.
Now that was, what, the early 30s?
Oh, that'd been before then. That was back, oh goodness, early 20s.
Uh-huh.
You know, we had a lot of forestation then that we don't have today.
Yeah,
I can remember acres and acres that were woods when I was a kid that are cleared off today.
And when they were growing tobacco for, I guess, chewing and now did they go through the warehouse system that way?
Yes.
Still did.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. But it was entirely different because you had no support price.
Yes, sir.
And my dad, I can remember him, saying that he's taken more than one crop to the market. And the buyer would say, give me the trash and the tips and I'll buy the good tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
That was the bargain at that time.
Uh-huh.
No price support.
Gee.
2 or 3, maybe 4 cents a pound.
Uh-huh. Now, what kind of tobacco was that? I mean, as far as the, was that a dark tobacco?
It was not hybrid. Of course, everything today is a hybrid, more or less. And farmers saved their seed. I remember my dad would pick out the biggest, best plants in the field. He'd let it go to seed. And then in the wintertime, he would tie that together and tie it high in the barn so that the mice and rats couldn't get it. And then in the spring, they'd shell that out, and that's what they seeded from. It was year to year they'd save their seed.
Now, when did that, in your recollection, do you remember about what time period that started to turn over?
When
they started buying seed?
Yeah, that's probably been about, in the early 50s, early 50s, I'd say, we started to get hybrid seed.
Tell me about the process of farming when you were, you know, from some of your earlier recollections. Now, they used to burn the beds.
Well, yeah, I've done a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I was probably the first person around here that used a chemical on a bed. The research farm next door here had done some experimental work, but it was small plots.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably about the first fellow around here that really made a chemical bed. Now, at that time, it was not chemicals that we use today. It was, they had some things like bed rinse and so on that you'd mix like a quart in 50 gallons and spray it on the bed and it soaked in and was supposed to kill the weed seed. And then we went to gas like Vorlex. I'm a great believer in methyl bromide.
Yeah.
I usually make my own beds and use methyl bromide, about 12 pounds to a bed.
Now, when you're, you've seen a lot of different kinds of equipment.
My earliest, no tractor. It was totally horses and a single line horse and a three shovel plow to plow tobacco. And how in the world we ever got it done, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Did they raise as much the back of the hen, or?
Probably acreage wise, mm-hmm. about as much. Of course, your yield was much, much smaller. They were much more particular with it. They used to, when you strip tobacco, it had to be not only in grade, but it had to be in length.
Oh, I see. Now, this was because of the warehouse demands, I guess.
This is what they wanted, they said.
Right.
This is what they wanted. Yes, we used to have to size it. You pull your lugs off, throw them in a pile, pick them up, tie a hand, pull the long leaves out, tie the short ones, and then pick the long ones up and tie that.
Gee.
So it was
double the process.
Kind of a double process.
Yeah. Now, I guess they had to use a lot more. They used a lot more labor then, a lot more hands.
Well, of course, at that time, the spear is a fairly recent innovation in tobacco.
Oh, I see.
Split tobacco with tobacco knife, and I was pretty proficient with those things.
Uh-huh.
Then the spear came along, and that speeded
saved
it up a whole lot.
Uh-huh. So they would split the stalk and then just actually put it on the stick in the field.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And, of course, the spear came along more or less as a necessity because of the type of tobacco we had, which grew much taller. You split tobacco with a tobacco knife, you couldn't reach shoulder high and do this. It had to be something down where you could reach it.
Uh-huh.
And the tobacco that they raised years ago did not grow tall, 6 feet and so on, like
uh-huh.
we have today. It was down fairly short, three feet
or
so. And it wasn't too bad then to use a knife on it, but the spear was sort of a necessary innovation to the type tobacco that we started to raise.
Now, the horse-drawn setters, did they set the same way they did, they pull a setter that had the water and you drop the planes.
Right, and a great innovation or a great invention, whatever you want to call it, was these automatic or mechanical setters that came along.
Yeah,
because you can almost set the back in your Sunday clothes today.
Sure. Yeah.
The old Tiger and Bemis and those things, they were horse-drawn.
Uh-huh.
It took a real team of horses to walk slow enough to do that.
Uh-huh. To pull that thing.
To pull it at the right speed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, was anybody doing hand setting when?
Years ago, back in the 30s and so on, they had the idea that you couldn't raise tobacco except on a hillside.
Oh, I see. Now, what was the theory behind that?
There was no theory. It was just,
it's
an old-time custom that
uh-huh.
you put your tobacco on the worst land and raised your corn and things on the best land.
Uh-huh.
I can remember we used to, every spring, my dad would plow the hillside, and we'd have to go out and roll the big rocks down the hillside and sled them off. And,
uh-huh.
and, of course, it was just too steep to put a setter on. And
sure.
We'd set this out by hand. Go along with a little short hoe. I've got one here if you want to see it.
Uh-huh.
And he'd set it in the ground, and I'd come along with a bucket of water and a tin cup and water and kick some dirt over it, and that's the way we set out tobacco,
uh-huh.
day after day.
Now, this part of this was, I guess tobacco wasn't as important to the farmer as far as his income earlier as it was later.
Well, I think tobacco has always been important to the farmer around here. As an income, we don't have, you only have to go as far north as Wellington, or even northern Brown County to see that we're not in soybean and corn country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We can't do what they do up there.
Right. The large, extensive
farm. Sure. So I think that the small, intensive, high cash value per acre is the lifeblood of this part of the country, as well as most other countries.
Mm-hmm. And you, as in your memory, it's really been like that.
Oh, it's always been like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, tobacco was very, very important. That's what paid off the mortgage. It was a mortgage lifter, really.
Sure.
You know.
Okay, tell me a little bit, if you can, about the way the actual leaf has changed over the years. Have, you know, the market demands, I guess, is what you call it. Has they wanted, what kinds of different kinds of tobacco have they wanted over the years?
Well, you know, I guess I'm not qualified Parker Tobacco Company or some of the buyers could tell you more about it. But
yeah.
I can remember what my dad said, that, mm-hmm. of course, when I was little, smaller,
uh-huh.
younger, whatever you want to call it, they raised tobacco then for chewing tobacco.
Yes.
And it was a red cherry color tobacco. Mm-hmm. And when it was stuck together, it sort of, when you pull it apart, you know, it wasn't dry like
it would stick.
A lot of stick together.
Uh-huh.
Well, then, of course, the history of cigarettes, and I don't know the whole history, but cigarettes became popular really during World War One.
Uh-huh.
Is when they became popular, and that
yes.
was, of course, late 1900, 1916,
1718. Right.
Cigarettes started to become popular with the troops, and then it gradually drifted back, so that the population here took it up.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that along about that time, the need for a different type of leaf is when it started.
Yeah.
Of course, the University of Kentucky has been a leader in developing leaf that the companies can use for these purposes.
Yeah. Now, when the filter cigarette came in, too, I think that made boosted, I guess, the tobacco economy.
Well, yes and no, because they don't use as much tobacco behind
oh.
it. In front of a filter
well,
as they do
true.
A non-filter.
Uh-huh.
The filter had its political, if that's the word,
yeah.
political emphasis or impact on the cigarette business and its advertising.
I see.
Less nicotine, low tar, all of this, and I don't know that that's necessarily true. But the filter did do one thing. The filter, when the filter came along, that's what made it really no longer necessary to sort your tobacco as close as we used to.
Oh, I see.
Because they could take a little of this and a little of that and mix it and put it behind a filter, and you couldn't hardly tell the difference.
Yeah.
Of course, in the whole tobacco process, the flavor of tobacco comes from burley.
Mm-hmm.
They put some flute cured, some Turkish, some
yeah.
exotics, and all this in it. But your kick or whatever you want, the taste of the cigarette has to come from your burley tobacco.
Uh-huh.
So,
now, when you were stripping, say, as a young man, uh-huh. Ordinarily, how would you strip the tobacco? How many grades?
Oh, you'd make. They made trash. Well, they made flines actually, which came from the very bottom, and then they made trash, which came from the next leaf up.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd run into your lugs, and they'd make at least two of those. So
uh-huh.
that's one, two, three. That's four grades.
Uh-huh.
Then you run into your bright leaf.
Right.
You might have one or two there, and then you get into your tip end, your red leaf. And then your tip, so
yeah.
probably 6 to 7 grades
mm-hmm.
on everything.
I see.
Or not grades, but 6 or 7 different groupings.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they would all be hand-tied separately and put on sold
oh, yeah.
separately.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Now, was there a big distinction in the price between the different grades or the types?
Well, not necessarily, because of the companies buy on quality.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a short leaf, generally they'll buy on quality.
Mm-hmm.
And they still do. It's not necessarily the length of the leaf, it's the quality that the buyers look for.
I see. Mm-hmm.
This can be a number of things that, of course, we as producers and farmers don't necessarily recognize when we strip the crop that this may be attractive or unattractive to the company.
Right, yeah.
Because we don't know exactly
what's there.
And of course, they buy on order. For instance, they may have, Reynolds may walk on the floor today and have an order
mm-hmm.
for some company, say for 300,000 pounds of a
right.
certain grade.
Uh-huh.
Well, when they fill that grade, they no longer, maybe nobody else wants it. So
sure.
the price
will drop
a little.
Yeah. Now, when did they start narrowing down the types they've stricken in. Has that come fairly recently?
Yeah, that's probably, I'd say in the probably early to middle 60s is when they really started their three grade, and some people two grade.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some tobacco, there's some tobacco that you can actually strip in two grades.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always found, and I'm real particular about it,
mm-hmm.
I've always found that you have at least three grades.
Right.
I've always run three grades.
Mm-hmm.
I run the trash and the lugs. No, I run the flying and the trash and maybe the very first lug leaf together.
Uh-huh.
And then I make a good lug grade.
Yeah.
Now you have two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on a normal year, if you have a good spread on tobacco, you can just about take what's left and make a grade of it.
Uh-huh.
But over and above this, you always have a throwout grade,
mm-hmm.
which would be damage,
sure.
a little bit of green, a little bit of this or that. So I always end up with four grades of tobacco.
Really, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You always have you should have a throwout pile.
Uh-huh. Sure.
For damage.
Yeah. Of course, you'll sell that, but.
Yeah, well, sometimes it sells as good as anything. So, you know,
depends on what their demand is.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Right. That's right.
Now, as far as mechanical changes over the years, what do you think has been most significant there? You mentioned the setter. Do you subscribe to any of the new harvesting?
Well, I guess probably the biggest labor saver that we've had is sucker control. I remember when I first started here, I'd go out early in the morning and start to break suckers, and you'd get to the end of the row and you'd empty your shoes, empty the water out, put them on, and go to the other end. It's that wet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it was a matter of necessity. And then, of course, after that, see, they used to sucker tobacco completely, first time over,
uh-huh.
sucker clear down. And then they would suck it another time and another time if necessary. This was quite a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
Well, then they got to the place where they would leave two suckers in the top.
Uh-huh.
And then the growth would go to those suckers instead of producing new ones.
I see.
And then just ahead, a day or two ahead of the spear and knife,
mm-hmm.
They'd go through there and you usually had to cut those top suckers. They
uh-huh.
were so tough you couldn't break them.
Yeah.
And you'd cut those out. That saved labor.
Uh-huh.
And then spray came along, and probably the spray, the MH-30, the spray for sucker control is
uh-huh.
is the biggest labor saver we have today. Other than that, a little change in the setter and the fact that we use tractors instead
mm-hmm.
of horses, everything's the same
just
way. It's the same way as it was 100 years ago.
Uh-huh.
That much changes.
Yeah. Curing the tobacco, farmers, I think, used to try to help it along more than they do now. Do you remember using coke?
No.
And y'all
no.
didn't do that.
I put a gas system in once.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, you can see the remnants of it here now.
Uh-huh.
It was not satisfactory because the gas has a natural moisture content to it
mm-hmm.
when it burns.
Yes, sir.
I found out that. Just good ventilation was better than trying to. Now some fellas used to use coke, and then coke
uh-huh.
got so expensive
yeah.
that you can't use it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The thing today is fans in the barn.
Mm-hmm.
These can be mounted on the end of the barn. They can even some of them are even mounted up on the rail in the barn so that they force air down through the tractor.
Mm-hmm.
This is the current thinking on curing the back of these fans.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Plenty of ventilation.
Okay. We talked about the stripping and when are you still hand tie or do you bale or?
The last crop I raised, which is 2 years ago, we hand tied it.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't raise it last year and I've got it granted this year.
Uh-huh.
It'll be baled.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yes, and if I raised another crop, as you can see, I've taken my old press out.
Right.
Still got the wall presses up. But,
uh-huh.
I would bale another crop.
Yeah, I see. What do you think the course, that's another labor-saving thing, too. And, you think the farmer loses anything by baling?
No, I think it's, I think that probably there is so much tobacco baled today that a hand-tied crop maybe starts to look a little bit out of place on the floor.
Sure.
Plus the fact that when the companies now are sort of set up to handle baled tobacco, and they have to handle hand-tied now, a little different process.
Right.
If you've been up at Parker,
yeah,
you've seen it.
Yeah.
They had to invent their
sure.
own little thing to knife the hand off. If it's baled tobacco, they don't have to
they
do
just run right through, right?
So I think in another, you know, this came about real quick. I remember
sure.
I was working at the warehouse in Maysville when we got the first bale in.
Uh-huh.
And it was odd, and the buyers didn't know what to make of it.
Right.
Some of it, they didn't want to bid on it. And, of course, now 90% of your tobacco is baled tobacco. So you have to go with the times.
Sure.
You may not like it. I don't like baled tobacco.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it makes a good appearance.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it even looks like tobacco on the warehouse floor.
Uh-huh.
But this is a new trend.
Yeah, I was surprised at how quickly that changed. You know, the tobacco farmers really are kind of a conservative, you know, been doing kind of the same thing for the last 50, 60 years, and to adapt to that so quickly.
Well, farmers are, you know, they're a pretty hard-headed bunch.
Uh-huh.
There's no doubt about that. But you have to understand that everybody from the University of Kentucky, Ira Massey and everybody, down to the county agents, were selling this idea to the
sure.
farmers.
Mm-hmm.
They were saying, hey, put in bales, or put in bale your tobacco, you can save 40% of your time. Well, that's not true. You don't save 40%. But that was the reason a lot of
that
sold.
Switched in my life. Tell me a little bit about what the farmer's relationship with the warehouseman. How do you pick a warehouseman, for example? Which warehouse you're going to sell at?
I'd probably pick a warehouse the same way as you pick an automobile dealer,
mm-hmm.
probably, where I think I'm treated fairly, where I think not necessarily that I got the most for my money, because I think tobacco sells generally for about the same price, whether it's Ripley or Maysville or one house or the other.
Uh-huh.
You form associations in the warehouse. There's probably not much loyalty involved when the farmer comes to the farmer.
Uh-huh.
But you see, I always have the attitude that when I load a crop of tobacco, that is my tobacco until I decide to let somebody have it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can even put it on the warehouse floor and decide, I don't want to sell it here.
Yeah.
See, this is my prerogative
uh-huh.
until I am offered a price that I'm satisfied with.
I see.
So the the relationship between the farmer and the warehouse is mainly the service that he gets from the warehouse, whether
mm-hmm.
he thinks he's been treated right or not. If he feels that he hasn't been treated, then go to the warehouse next door if he
sure.
wants to. That's his crop.
Yeah. What do you think about raising tobacco today? What do you think are some of the biggest problems for a tobacco farmer? And, how can they respond?
You mean from the standpoint of the health issue? Or
well, no, not from that. I was thinking about just making a living trying to raise tobacco.
I think there's a lot of factors that are going to determine tobacco program
mm-hmm.
from now on. Mostly it's going to come from the political arena.
Mm-hmm.
We have some, I guess you can, I don't know of any issue that you could bring up that somebody wouldn't be against it
mm-hmm.
or for it.
I see. Uh-huh.
We have this to combat today. As a matter of fact, we have even our two state senators, Glenn
uh-huh.
and Metzenberg.
Glenn
and Metzenbaum, who are not for us.
Uh-huh.
We're not very big in tobacco here in this part of the country as compared to
Kentucky. Yeah.
I think our tobacco crop last year, and I don't hold me to this figure,
uh-huh.
but I believe in Ohio last year was something like a $38 million crop.
Mm-hmm.
I I wonder what our governor would say if suddenly a big corporation decided to locate in Brown County and going to have a payroll of $38 million. You know, this would be headlines.
Sure.
Oh, they crow to high heaven over $38 million industry locating in Southern Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And yet we have that same thing here, but we can't get support from these people.
Yeah.
About a month ago, we had some people here from Channel 5 in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Their cameras, and they were making something for their 6 o'clock news.
Uh-huh.
And I asked the lady reporter, I said, are you going to come to our tobacco festival next week?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I'd like to come if you change the name of it. And I said, what's the matter with the name? And she said, you've got that one little word in there I don't like.
Uh-huh.
So this is what we combat out there.
Sure.
During the festival, I had a chance to, I talked quite a long time there with one of the vice presidents of R.J. Reynolds Company.
Mm-hmm.
He's a vice president of lead or sales or I don't know what.
Uh-huh.
But he said that the problem that the companies have with the government on this health issue, and this really upsets me,
uh-huh.
is the fact that the companies have told the government if there's anything harmful or so on in tobacco, tell us what it is, we'll take it out.
Yeah.
But nobody, as he said, nobody yet has told us that there's anything harmful or if there is,
what it is.
Right. He said, we can take it out, no problem, if you'll mm-hmm. tell us what it is.
Yeah.
It's a big issue. I sometimes think that they have their priorities misplaced. I guess I'd rather see them. I don't know of anybody that's ever smoked a cigarette made out of tobacco, gotten in the car and driven down the road to kill somebody because he smoked.
Mm-hmm.
I know of statistics say that 50% of our fatal auto sure. accidents, alcohol is concerned, and I just think the government has a misplaced priority
yeah.
on this.
Uh-huh. Pushing against it so hard.
I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong. I am just saying that people, if I produce it and put it on the market, I am not forcing anybody to buy it. That is your prerogative. Take it or leave it. And that's all we're saying to the people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's your choice.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't like milk, then I don't want somebody to
push it off on me.
And yet the dairy farmer has a right to produce milk if
sure.
he wants to, but I don't have to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess tobacco would still be grown if there weren't a program, but it would push out a lot of the little people.
You see, the problem is, it's like a lot of industry today. A lot of our manufacturing has gone to Taiwan and Hong Kong,
uh-huh.
and Japan, and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not enough of an economist to know why this happens, although I have my own ideas.
Uh-huh.
But you see, and I can't understand our politicians that don't realize this. If they knock the tobacco program out in Brown County and Kentucky, then they're probably going to have to build additions to all the welfare offices in these counties because
sure.
we're all going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I can't understand our politicians when they want to do away with our program, which has been, and probably the reason is because our representatives in Washington cannot stand success or any program that works. If it works, tear it up.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to get radical here, but you see, that seems to be the thing. Our tobacco program has worked for
sure.
30, over 30 years now. It's
mm-hmm.
worked.
Yeah.
And yet they want to do away with it.
Mm-hmm. You think the result will be foreign?
The result will be that they'll go to South Africa,
mm-hmm.
Rhodesia, or which is now Zimbabwe,
yeah. right.
Australia,
yeah.
Canada, they're still going to get the required pounds of tobacco to make
sure.
cigarettes. If we don't raise it, somebody else will. Sure. The auto manufacturers in Detroit kind of slipped up, and
mm-hmm.
Japan put one over on them, and we're still paying for that. And
sure.
You see, the problem is that once the program works,
mm-hmm.
not perfect. I'm not
sure.
saying it is. It's
uh-huh.
got bugs in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it works. It's something we can live with. It's something we're satisfied with.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see why the government wants to do away with something like this.
This is side two of a tape with Russell Wilson. What accounts for the fact that tobacco farmers seem to have a hard time getting labor, to help them, particularly around harvest time and stripping time?
Well, I don't want to get real political on it. Probably too much welfare.
Uh-huh.
I have hired help that I knew was on the welfare program. They mm-hmm. will not take a check.
I see.
Because there's a record. Say, yeah, I'll work. You're going to pay me in cash.
Uh-huh.
So I'd say that our programs of, I have to sort of term it as giveaway.
Sure.
In a way.
Yeah.
I think these programs hurt.
Well, it makes it, if they did get reported income, I guess they get thrown out of the program.
Well, true. Of course, the other thing is minimum wage, which I never could understand.
Mm-hmm.
Minimum wage of $3.35, you draw $3.35 whether you work or not.
Yeah.
So if you work a little bit, you want more than that. So that's forced our prices up to,
mm-hmm.
I understand some places in Kentucky, they'll pay as high as $7, $8 an hour for a pretty good hand.
Yeah, I know. That kind of takes me back to that question before. A young man say that was taking over a farm.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think raising tobacco is a promising thing for him? Is that why it seems to me that tobacco is getting more and more in the hands of a few individuals. Is that because it takes a lot of income?
Probably as pertains to tobacco, but not only that, but anything. Today.
Sure.
If you could afford. If you could afford today to go out and buy a farm and equip it
mm-hmm.
and start to farm, then you'd make more money to invest it at 10% somewhere
sure.
because you're not going to make a 10% return on your farm operation.
Mm-hmm.
So you either farm for the joy of it
mm-hmm.
or just to put in time.
Yeah.
So the average farmer today, if he could get what his farm is worth, what it was 4, 5, 6 years ago, when farms sold for $1,000, $1,500, $1,800. If you could get that today, probably the average farmer, and myself included, you'd be better to sell out, invest the money for the 10% and let somebody else worry
about it.
Right. The only thing that keeps me here is the fact that it's probably the last vestige of independence left in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And even not in tobacco, but even in agriculture, it's becoming, and I don't want to sound anti-anything here, but
sure.
it's becoming unionized.
Yeah.
It's no longer the independence. And farmers like to think that they're independent. You don't tell me what to do, and yet the government every day tells us what
sure.
to do.
Do you think is that something that distinguishes the tobacco farmer, say, from the big soybean and corn operations?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that anybody in agriculture of any kind faces this problem.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
But and they, you think they all feel that independence pretty much the same?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. You're a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You face teacher problems,
mm-hmm.
and I know what some of these are. You're worried about retirement. You're worried about pay scales.
Sure.
You're worried about tenure.
Yeah.
So you have problems too. We all have problems.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of parallels between these two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess I'm concerned. My long-term concern is mm-hmm. that not only that, also in the tobacco business, this will happen.
Mm-hmm.
That foreign interests and big conglomerates will, in the next next 20, 25 years are going to control agriculture in this country.
Yes.
And when that happens, you will have a man that will work 8 hours a day and let the fruit rot because it's 4 o'clock and I'm going home.
Yeah. Right.
Or put me on overtime.
Sure.
We have some symptoms of this today in this state. I don't know whether you have any in Kentucky or not.
Well, that kind of bodes poorly, probably for Kentucky and Ohio, and I'm talking about our area, because we don't have the farmland that really will allow for that large-scale type operation.
Yeah, we don't have it. Southwestern Kentucky has some area down in Bowling Green and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what worries me a little bit, and I guess this is what makes me say that the tobacco farmer, like myself, with some pounds that we can sell at a, you know, a guaranteed sort of a price is the last vestige of really independence in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Because now, just for instance, this year you have the PIC program,
sure,
which made the grain farmer, he's no longer independent.
Yeah.
Now, see, he's given up his independence. As long as I can have a vote as to whether we're going to maintain a tobacco program, as long as I can have a vote for it, I'm happy.
Yeah.
When somebody else starts to vote for me, then I'm going to become very unhappy.
Yeah, and that is something that a lot of people don't realize, that the farmers themselves decide on that.
Sure, sure.
I guess price and,
sure,
and how the program's going to be run.
And, of course, one of the biggest misunderstandings out here, and you hear commentators on radio,
mm-hmm,
on television, in newspapers, magazines, they refer tobacco as being a subsidized program,
mm-hmm,
and it is not subsidized. I can get you stacks of literature from the University of Kentucky that will show you that tobacco is not a subsidized crop.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years since, and I just happen to remember this figure, over the years since the tobacco program came in,
mm-hmm,
which was way back in the 30s,
yeah,
the government has expended $58 million, give or take a little,
mm-hmm,
toward the tobacco program. And this has gone into administration. They hire the government graders.
Sure.
They have some administrative costs.
Mm-hmm.
But over 50 years almost,
yeah,
the government has expended $58 million on a crop that has made them billions in taxes,
right,
excise, cigarette,
yeah,
tax, everything.
Sure.
I just can't understand some of these politicians.
And then the to add, I guess, injury to insult, the this no net cost, I guess, has come in now.
Well, no net cost. Last year it was just a penny or two a pound. This year they say it's going to be at least 7 cents a pound.
Mm-hmm. For some of these farmers that had to lease some tobacco to grow, that's going to be the difference between,
right,
making money,
particularly,
and losing money.
In a short crop year. Because the just saw in the Maysville paper yesterday,
mm-hmm,
day before yesterday, they figured the tobacco crop in Kentucky this year is going to be 60% short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we all face problems.
This one.
Thank goodness we didn't come in with a crop like we had last year.
Sure.
I'll take that short crop this year.
Yeah, because of the big, had there been a big crop, I guess it would have been more.
Wouldn't know what to do with it this year.
You think the idea that this year there is a short crop will preserve the program a
little
bit longer?
Absolutely. Well, you see what, I don't know how much you keep up with this, but you see what, how much the Burley Co-op has sold in the last month out of their supplies.
Right, they're already starting to sell.
Oh, yeah, they've had, goodness, 1 week they sold $30 million, the next week $40 million, and they only had $100 and some million to start with.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah.
So keep it up a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Work off a lot of surplus.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you talking to me today.
Okay.